Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today we're falling in many different flavors. And we're at number 3.
So next we have a story of a different kind of fall.
All right.
Or faller.
Yeah.
Comes from science writer David Quammen.
One article in particular that he wrote caught our attention.
All right. I'm going to quote you to yourself.
Okay.
Nowadays, true enough, we know quite a bit about cats. They've been dissected in uncountable numbers. Their anatomy, their physiology, their behavior have been minutely studied. But there's much that we still don't know. Among all the other intractable issues, one in particular arrests me. What's the terminal velocity of a plummeting cat?
Why? Can you give me a little history? Why did that question arrest you?
I mean, when I used to write for Outside Magazine, I would browse through journals and I would come across obscure papers. How I happened upon the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, familiarly known as JVAMA, I don't know. I don't remember. But I'm sure that that was the starting point.
Because it was in that journal that David ran across a research paper by two vets.
Wayne Whitney and Cheryl Melhoff.
Who worked in
the Midtown Veterinary Hospital, right there on 6th Avenue and 72nd.
And they noticed that in Manhattan,
there were a lot of cats falling out of windows, high windows, falling off ledges, falling off roofs.
And what is a lot? I mean, how many cats were coming into this place?
We saw 132 cats fall in a five-month summer period.
132.
That's Anne Hohenhaus. She actually works in the veterinary hospital.
And here at the Animal Medical Center.
And she's been there since that research paper was written back in 1986.
When I came to New York City, I said, what do you mean cats fall out of buildings? Doesn't make sense. I said, why would the cat fall out?
But we'll get back to her in just a little bit.
132 in 5 months? That's almost
really
a rain of cats.
Well, no, don't say that, because I think people should visit New York without receiving umbrellas.
62.
What are you doing?
I'm doing the math to see how many that is in a week of... can you do a day?
35 days. It's about four cats a day, isn't it, Jed?
Jeez. I think it's actually a little less, but so falling out of buildings is what this.
Well, it's a shame. We can all agree about that.
But according to David, it's actually not as much of a shame as you would think.
22 of the cats that they saw had fallen from 8 stories or higher, and out of those 22, only one died.
Wow.
So 21 cats survived from 8 stories or higher.
Wow, that's a long way.
And there was one cat that fell 32 stories, and the cat had a little bit of sort of thoracic bruising and a chipped tooth, and that was it.
So how in the world do cats, we all know cats land on their feet, yeah, but how do they do that? Like, these are not magical creatures.
Well, if you go back about 1,000 years.
It was thought that they consorted with witches, with the devil. And their reputation got darker and darker. Mm-hmm. The more people started to distrust and dislike cats, the more they started to do horrible things to them. They would put cats in a barrel and then they would run the barrel through with swords. Also throwing them out of windows. The defenestration of cats.
What does a defenestration mean?
Is throwing out the window.
Really?
The fenestra is the
There's
window.
There's a word
so
for
if
that?
Jad, add that to your active vocabulary today.
I plan to. So what would happen when they would defenestrate these cats?
The cats would land on their feet and walk away. And that made people even crazier.
No, of course, we love our cats now. We don't do that to our cats anymore.
But when we went to visit Anne back at the veterinary hospital, mm-hmm. we were asking her about the falling cats research paper, which is called the
feline high-rise syndrome.
Then the mystery of how cats can fall from these amazing heights and survive got a lot deeper.
Yeah.
Well, cats that fell less than 5 stories.
They did fine, she said.
Not too bad. Cats that fell over 9 stories.
They did fine too, she says.
Not so bad.
Which is weird.
But
cats that fell between 5 and 9.
Between 5 floors and 9 floors?
Had really serious injuries and had more injuries per cat.
So cats that fell a little ways were okay. Cats that fell a long ways were okay, weirdly. But this 5 to 9 thing?
And so, how do you account for that?
Yeah, what's going on?
We had to get a physicist to help us explain this.
This is where we get back to what Quammen calls
the terminal velocity issue.
Or here's how Anne put it to us.
Well, say you're living on the 30th floor of a building and it's summertime.
You get done at work at 5, you go home, get there about 6, the apartment's hot and stuffy, and you open up those windows. And Fluffy says, I'd like that pigeon out there. And the next thing you know, the misstep, and as the cat starts to fall, he's all disoriented.
And almost immediately,
probably within the first 6 feet,
the cat's brain says, okay, turn your front half over, now bring your back legs around.
That's like instinct.
Cat can apparently do that move lickety-split.
But the cat is still speeding up.
Going faster and faster.
3 floors. 5 floors, 7 floors.
And after falling about 9 floors?
And accelerating the speeds?
Up to about 60 miles an hour.
Something happens.
You hit an equilibrium between the pull of gravity and wind resistance.
What he means is gravity is pulling down on you, and the peak pull is between 5 and 9 floors for a cat. But after 9 floors, the wind resistance, which all the while has been pushing back up on you, starts to slow you down.
You don't speed up anymore.
So that's your cruising speed.
That's your cruising speed. After the cats hit terminal velocity and the sensation of acceleration was gone, they relaxed. They sort of stretch out like a flying squirrel. And then they hit the ground, belly flop.
And you're saying that because they hit this cruising speed and then relax into the flying squirrel, the impact is less?
Yes.
Yeah, and our record here, it wasn't in this paper, but our record is 42 floors and the cat walked away.
Wow.
42 floors. Is that a lucky cat or is that just plain physics? Should cats everywhere go to the 42nd floor before jumping out of the window?
No cat should ever jump out of a window.
That's right, stay indoors. No Fluffy, back. Okay, so the next falling, what are we going to call these? Falling episodes. No, is there an F word you could use?
Features.
Yes. Oh, great, great.
Our next falling feature.
Oh, boy.
Okay, no, I mean, it's up to you.
We invited Columbia University physics professor Brian Greene into our studio.
Do I get to play with any buttons?
Yeah.
We wanted to ask him, well, really one of the most basic questions you could ask a physicist.
Why do we fall?
You know, we all know that Newton wrote down a law of gravity to calculate how gravity acts from one object to another.
Yeah, like if you drop your pen.
That's right. But there's a difference between being able to predict what will happen and be able to explain why it happens. And Newton could not explain why it happens. He could only tell you what would happen.
But I mean, how it works is it just pulls the pen down.
What does that mean, though? How's it pull it? I don't see anything between the table and your pen. So what is the agent responsible for the pull?
This is something even Albert Einstein himself couldn't quite figure out.
He was struggling to understand how the force of gravity works. And it was a big, big puzzle.
And the legend goes that Albert Einstein was walking around one day and he found himself imagining a person riding in an elevator. And all of a sudden, the cable gets cut and the elevator starts a plunge right down towards the earth.
The version I know is that he was actually sitting at his desk looking out the window and was imagining window washers falling sort of from their scaffolding. But it's the same exact idea.
But anyway, we're going to stick with the elevator version for now. Einstein imagined this person standing actually on a bathroom scale.
In the elevator.
In the elevator. This is before the cable gets cut.
If the person is in the elevator standing on a scale, they see that they weigh 160 pounds.
And then, snip.
When the elevator cable is cut, they look down at the scale and the scale will drop to zero. Because the scale will be falling away from their feet at exactly the same rate that their feet are falling. So their feet won't push on the scale any longer because the scale will be moving downward with them.
In my mind, I imagine like a Hollywood movie where it's falling so fast that everybody kind of drifts up.
That's almost right. So Einstein said to himself, hang on a second. Here's an environment where, in essence, I can turn gravity off. Another way of saying it that flips it around and may make it more clear. Just as you can turn gravity off by snapping the cable, you can actually simulate gravity by pulling on the cable that pulls that elevator up really, really quickly. Because now the scale is running into your feet. If you're standing on that scale, it won't read 160, it might read 250.
Huh. It seems like gravity and being pulled up really fast They're the same thing.
They are.
Chad, look at that. Look at you. You just had the insight on your own.
That's right.
He walked us 17 steps, and I just made the last baby step.
You did it. You did it, man.
Wow.
So whenever you're faced with a gravitational problem, this allowed you to ignore gravity and translate it into a problem about motion.
But does that solve the what is gravity question? It just sort of...
No. He then had to make one more leap. And it's not obvious how he took the final step. But the final step was to realize that the what is gravity is the curvature of space and time. That's a leap.
Well, I don't know what that means.
Well, this is a very difficult concept.
Do you understand it?
I understand what Einstein tells you when he explained it. He said, if you imagine the universe as a vast rubber mat, held really, really taut,
yeah.
Let's just take, let's take the Earth and just plop it onto the mat. So what just happened?
Well, it sunk into the rubber.
It stretched the rubber, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
and so the rubber is kind of curved around underneath it.
Yeah.
In Einstein's mind, he thought, maybe this is how to explain gravity. This is what gravity is.
That curved shape of space, he said.
Hmm.
And the pen falls because it's following a contour in that curved space-time environment.
So like if we're living on the curve, then we're constantly
falling. We're constantly moving down that curve. Yeah, yeah. We have no choice.
And the reason why right now I feel the chair pushing up on me is, again, my body also wants to slide down, but the chair is getting in the way.
So we're all sort of on some kind of slope sliding down.
Yes,
unless we're...
That's right. That's right.
I like that. Yeah. I'm now an adherent to that theory.
There you go.
Not knowing anything else. Now for number 5... Should we call it Falling Fortunes or?
Well, Falling Fortunes is a good one for this, I think.
Yeah.
Because someone is seeking fame and fortune and then...
falls.
The idea of the gravity hero, to me, one of the things that it goes along with...
Was that a term that was used, gravity heroes?
No. That's my term.
I like it, though. It's a really catchy term.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
This is Garrett Soden. He's an author.
Author of Defying Gravity.
Original title.
Falling, How Our Greatest Fear Became Our Greatest Thrill, A History.
And speaking of history and fears and thrills, and I would add to that list tragedy, he tells the following story.
It really started with Niagara Falls, because up to that point, people had done all kinds of things at Niagara Falls.
To back up, it is the 1850s, and at Niagara Falls, you've got these two guys doing tightrope tricks over the falls.
Yeah.
A fellow named Charles Blondin.
Famous French wire walker.
And a Canadian guy who called himself...
The Great Farini.
And they would duke it out.
Right. Blondin came out, strung a rope across Niagara Falls, put a chair down, balanced on two legs, and stood on it.
Whoa.
And one time he carried a guy over.
Oh, wow.
He had to keep upping the ante, so...
So, for his greatest trick...
He carried a small cast iron stove on his back.
Wow.
With some firewood. He got out there and he put the stove down, lit a fire, had a couple of eggs in a frying pan, and made an omelet.
Right over this churning, like, rapid?
Yes.
Wow.
So the Great Farini came out with a washing machine. That was his answer to Blondin. Wash some clothes out there, yeah.
But the thing to know about these guys is that this was basically just a show. Because, for example, the wire that they walked on was pretty wide.
About the diameter of a coffee cup.
And really, they were just avoiding the big trick.
The most anticipated trick.
The one that everybody was waiting for.
Was somebody going over the falls in the barrel.
The guy who did that would be the real gravity hero, you wire-walking wusses. Niagara Falls is one of the great forces of nature. Every second, 600,000 gallons fall over the edge, pound rocks below with such a fury that you can hear it 5 miles away. Which is why in 1850, when P.T. Barnum saw the falls...
He said that if someone could figure out a way to go over that, that would be a huge stunt that would give them fame and fortune.
That's Joan Murray.
I'm a poet.
She's a poet. She's written a whole book.
In verse.
About the first person to conquer the falls.
In a barrel.
And it's called?
Queen of the Mist.
Queen of the Mist, huh.
Yep.
So it wasn't a guy then?
No, I just said it was a guy to set you up so that you would ask me that question. Because in fact, it was a woman.
Wow. Props to her.
Thank you for acting surprised.
What's her name, Chad?
Annie Taylor.
When we first meet Annie Taylor,
This was 1901.
She was...
down on her luck.
She'd been a... she'd done a lot of different things. She had run a dancing school. She had been a principal. She had traveled all over the world.
Her only child had died. Her husband, right after that. And she was broke. But then it hit her.
Gravity!
She was sitting at home.
Sitting in her apartment.
In Bay City, Michigan.
And for some odd reason, she read an article about the goings-on at Niagara Falls, and she decided she would go over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, do we know?
She's looking to save herself from the poorhouse.
She was after money.
And when she read about these guys at Niagara Falls, she thought, this is it.
Right. So she called a cooper to build the barrel. At first, he refused to build it when he heard what her plan was, but finally he did.
And not long after, Annie was on a train with her barrel, headed to the falls. By the way, what day are we talking about, just so we have a date
stamp? On October 24th in 1901.
Okay.
Word had spread.
This was going to be a spectacle.
Everyone was there.
Mobs of people.
Thousands.
Up and down the river.
Tens of thousands, and Annie shows up.
Waving to the crowd.
Wearing a very fancy Victorian dress.
And a hat with ostrich feathers.
Wow.
She's quite the lady. But then they go on an island where she changes.
Into some gym clothes.
And now she gets in the barrel.
They tow her out to the middle of the river.
And then they knock and cut the rope. And off she goes to the brink.
The roar of the river.
Enormous. And it's wet at my feet, and I'm feeling while I'm in there that this is miserable.
Interesting thing is that in Joan's poem, she actually becomes Annie.
I careened and spun.
She's in the barrel, getting hurled down the river, tossed and turned.
My brain toyed.
And as she gets closer to the edge, it's about a half-mile journey, she begins to hallucinate.
And I glimpse through the turbulence. There was my young husband. In his arms, our baby, trembling and whimpering as on the day.
And then?
This moment of weightlessness.
She's going...
down. Into the pools below.
The great mass of foam and boiling water.
And then, she shoots out again.
Through the buoyancy of the barrel, about 15 feet in the air.
Wow. The barrel crashes back.
Back down on the water.
And then it floats. Over to some rocks. And a rescue team paddle out to the barrel right away.
They get the barrel and they have to saw it open.
The crowd, no doubt, is thinking, that woman is dead. There is nothing but a dead woman in that barrel.
But
when they pull her out.
She's alive. I am alive. She took on this thing that the world was waiting for. And she did it. She was the first to ever try.
And Joan, when she was pulled out of that barrel, and presumably she's going to take the next step into fame and fortune, what happened?
More or less nothing. She stepped out of the barrel and she didn't look right. She didn't look like a hero.
What does that mean?
Well, I've kept something from you, Carl.
What?
The thing I haven't told you is that not only was she wet and soggy and, according to newspaper accounts, hysterical, I mean, who wouldn't be, she was 63.
She was your grandmother.
She was an older lady. Like Joan said, you know, for the hero-consuming public, she just didn't look right.
After that exhibition, her manager ran off with the barrel. And he took the barrel and he started going on the circuit with a lovely young woman that he claimed was Annie Taylor.
No.
Much better showpiece.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What happened to Annie, though?
She would drag herself to Niagara each spring and summer.
She would just sit on a street with a barrel. It wasn't the original barrel, but it was a barrel.
And do what?
She probably had photographs of herself that she signed.
And did she ever make any money off this?
No, she died in a poorhouse.
Which is where she didn't want to wind up,
wow.
But that is where she wound up.
And just 10 years later, Somebody repeats Annie's feat.
A man, and he tours the world.
Bastard.
Yeah, bastard.
But...
because the heavens are merciful.
During this guy's victory lap as he's traveling around the world.
He slipped on an orange rind in Australia or New Zealand, got a compound fracture of his leg.
Ha! She says that leg got gangrene and he died.
Yeah. There is cosmic justice.
Since I failed.
Back.
This is Anne Hohenhaus reading the Radio Lab credits. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
The George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success.
Learn more at edutopia.org.
And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.